Afternoon. This is the House Committee on Revenue. It's shortly after 1 o'clock. We'll go ahead and start now, just a little bit late, and we do have a full complement of the committee here today. We welcome you and encourage your attendance and to be on time. First of all, I'd like to introduce our legislative fiscal officer, Dr. Paul Warner. And Paul, would you like to introduce your staff for us, please?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm your legislative revenue officer.
Oh, did I say fiscal? I did, didn't I?
Yep, your past has followed you.
I watched you on TV with the legislative fiscal officer last night, and the two of you, the one with the ponytail wasn't.
I don't know which one of us will be insulted by that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office, and we will be staffing your committee. We also staff the Senate Revenue Committee, so we work with both chambers. We have on our staff five economists, including myself, and our other. We have three of our other economists here: Mazen Malik, who handles our excise taxes, gasoline taxes, beer and wine taxes, cigarette taxes, lottery, various things. And Mazen will spend the day kind of going through those and those revenue items with you. Mary Ayala is our newest member, came to us from the Florida Department of Revenue this past summer. She's going to do our property tax analysis, and so any property tax bill Mary will be working on. Elizabeth Martin Mahar is does our personal and corporate income taxes. She also kind of is the keeper of our OTIM tax incidence model. And so she feeds the model and takes care of it. So each of our economists act as an administrator for the bills that they're working on. So unlike other committees where you have a single administrator, our economists will serve as administrator for individual bills in their particular areas. We also work very closely with Dexter Johnson from Council. Dexter drafts most all of the tax bills and many of the revenue bills. And we've also, over the years, had a very close working relationship with the Department of Revenue. Deborah Buchanan is here from the department, and she'll be here every day. She does most of the income tax issues. And John Phillips does the property tax and local government issues from the Department of Revenue. The department is, as well as working with us on tax administration issues, is the source of most of our data in terms of analyzing different proposals.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We welcome you, and please feel free to access each of the members of our committee. And I have a special time of the day that you can come and meet with me to set your alarm clocks early. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and spend the next few minutes having the ladies and gentlemen of the committee introduce themselves, and I'm going to start to my immediate left with the ladies here, and we will start with you, if we could, please, Representative Berger, and we'll go to Representative Comte after.
I'm Representative Vicki Berger, District 20, which is the Salem area. This is my second term, and I was on revenue last session and learned a lot, and now I'm trying to get back up to speed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And then if you'll tell us what district you're from and a little bit of background, and then we'll come back to your background.
Okay.
And then what brings you to Salem?
Oh, what brings me to Salem? Mm-hmm. To be here in this wonderful company. My name is Representative Betty Comp. I am from House District 22, and that's Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and North Salem. And a little bit about my background. I am an educator. I've been in schools since 1990, and I love being around students, and I'm glad that a lot of people around here like to have some fun. It's like being with eighth graders. I'm a middle school principal. And the reason what brings me to the legislature is I'm a strong proponent of equity. I believe in all of us having our basic rights and to have equalization of what those rights look like. And the other reason that I'm here is you'll always find that I talk about family. They're the most dearest things to my heart, and that I believe that Oregon is a great place to raise a family, and I want to make it better.
Great. Thank you very much, Representatives Berger and Comp. Well, I'm going to come back over now to my right, and we'll start with Representative Haas as the vice chair.
Thank you. Mark Haas. I represent the parts of Beaverton and southwest Portland. This is my third term in my eighth legislative session. And I'm a reformed journalist for 20 years. I worked in journalism, mostly radio and TV stations. I came down here because I grew up in this state and felt that somewhere in the 90s, somewhere in there, we sort of all felt Oregon sliding backwards a little bit, and came down here to try and stop the slide and maybe move things forward again.
Thank you, Mark. Continue with Representative Boquist.
I'm Representative Brian Boquist. I represent the 23rd House District, which is parts of rural Yamhill, parts of rural Polk, parts of rural Benton, parts of rural Lynn, and parts of rural Marion County, which, like myself, is comprised of farmers and ranchers, small woodlot owners, and small businesses. And besides that, and in addition to that, I'm also a reserve military officer. And so I'm pretty much a reflection, whether it's Democrat or Republican, of my district, a rural small business owner, simply trying to get Salem to be on our side.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon. Larry Galizio, House District 35. It's my first term. And House District 35 is Tigard, a little bit of southwest Portland by Portland Community College, which is actually where I come from. I teach at PCC, the Sylvania campus, been there for 12 years, and enjoy and am very interested in public policy, and am honored to be in this situation to help craft that and hope to construct policy that's effective for Oregonians, and I look forward to learning a lot on the Revenue Committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Andy Olson. I'm from House District 15, which is Albany in Benton County. And I retired about a year and a half ago as a station commander with the Oregon State Police, spending 29 years with them. So I come with a background of accountability. Not that people want to know that, but then also I believe very strongly in leadership, and that's what I would like to bring with me here.
Thank you very much, Representative Olson. Let's come down to Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Representative Butler. My name's Sal Esquivel. I'm from District 6, which is actually Medford. I think I have 17 constituents that live outside the city. So it's not what I'd call rural. Why am I here? I was thinking about that while everyone was talking, and actually it was about over eight years ago. I was so frustrated with the city government, I decided to run for an office and ended up as on that city council for over 7 years. This last March, I was appointed to the Senate and served in the Senate until just recently when I did win my election for the House race down in the Medford area. I think the only reason I'm actually here is because I think I can make a difference. We have a long history of our family being in Oregonians. My grandpa actually settled in the valley in the 1880s. We're a sixth-generation family. Grew up there, still live there. All of our children except one live there. And if we can make that better, then so be it. But there are some times that it's very self-gratifying being in a position we're in. Example, helping the people that can't get help themselves, and we get constituents' calls. And those are probably the most self-satisfying parts of being a elected official in the state of Oregon. It's when you can help the little, what they think as a little guy or gal, get something done through the bureaucracy and cut through all the mires and the layers that are in front of them to get satisfaction and get something done correctly.
Thank you, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Chuck Riley, and I represent House District 29. That's Forest Grove, Cornelius, and a big chunk of Hillsborough, which is where I live. I've been a business consultant for several years. I own my own small business as a business consultant. And I retired a couple of years ago, and Oregon has been really good to me, and I think I can help make a difference, make things work better, solve some problems, and so I'm here to do so. I don't talk as long as Representative Esquivel, but that's...
We'll keep you, Representative.
Okay. Right. Thank you very much for being here today.
It comes from being on the Senate side.
There we go.
Thank you very much. I'm from House District 60, and I need to just tell you about House District 60. It's very aptly and appropriately described in the Bible. It says, on the sixth day after the earth was created, God said, "It is glorious and beautiful," and he was in House District 60 in order to say that. It is a beautiful portion of the state of Oregon. It's the largest house district in the state. I think I have more cows than I have constituents in just one of the counties. So at any rate, I'll check my boots and check underneath of them too, boot for boot with Representative Boquist to see what we've got on our boots there. But
it smells.
It smells, yeah. It includes all of Harney County, all of Mount Hare County, the two largest counties in the state, and all of Baker County, together with the southeast portion of Grant County. In my real life, I've been a CPA, and I've already showed this to Paul. I'm going to pull it out. Well, I thought I had it. I guess I don't have it. Maybe my staff will be kind enough to bring it down. I was featured in the National CPA Magazine last week as a CPA who gives time to the public good. And there's not a lot of CPAs, and I don't know if that's indictment against the CPAs themselves. They just don't get involved that much, it seems, in these kinds of activities. But I've appreciated the opportunity to serve. I look forward to serving with each one of you. I've had an opportunity to meet individually with you and look forward to serving with each member. And the only reason that I'm the chair isn't because I'm better looking. I don't know. There's two or three. Well, probably all of you could beat that one. It isn't necessarily because I'm older. There's probably one or two of you that's going to challenge me for that. And it isn't because I'm more smart, and that ain't keeping a secret anyway. It's just because I've been around here longer, I think. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to act as your chair, and I've already met with you and encouraged you, and we'll set up a schedule so that particularly as we go through the orientation, we'll allow each of you to come down and be the chair. And I would hope that we could all be respectful of the fact that the questioning comes through the committee, a chair back and forth to those who would testify. Now, if I could just do a couple of housekeeping things before we actually get started. If you've got cell phones, you may want to put those on buzz and on quiet tone. I'm not sure there probably is a notice outside the meeting room, but we'll forget that from time to time. I'm not going to have a fit and fall in it. But we'll if we could kind of be respectful of those issues. Also, if you've got concerns, problems, hand notes up and down the diet here so that we can communicate in that fashion. If we run into problems while we're working bills as we get into that particular portion, what I'd like to do is I'd like to be able to call a brief recess or an at-ease from time to time, and we'll try and be respectful of the feelings of one another and recognize that we do have some party politics that may be played out in this process, and I hope that doesn't mire us down at any point. I'd also ask you to please be, and we each received some information on the House floor today relative to being courteous to your fellow members of the legislature, and I would exhort you to follow that same procedure in this committee process, that you be as respectful and courteous to your other members as you possibly can, and to those who will come to testify, that you pay attention to those that come to testify. There are times when maybe someone is going on a little longer than they should. Pass me a note. We'll try and hold the time down. But at any rate, I guess I would just say this, that if we just treat others as we'd like to be treated, I think we'll do fine in that process. The first order of business, it shows orientation overview, but we have a set of rules here, proposed committee rules, and I just offer those rules up to you. Oh, Thank you very much. My beautiful bride. This is my wife. She's the person that makes it possible for me to come. This is Mrs. Darlene Butler. Thank you. And she's brought this, and I want the camera to hone in on that ring. And my children think I make a great centerfold in here. Here's Butler on the inside here. Is this too much for you, or everything old school?
Really is, sir.
Mr. Chair, where did you have that printed?
We haven't been able to authenticate that this is a real magazine. But that was a singular honor for me to have those folks approach us with that opportunity, and I do appreciate the opportunity to have been a certified public accountant in the state of Oregon and the state of California for many, many years, and to have applied my talents here, and that's why I'm here, is to return back to the state of Oregon for the goodness that they have been to our family and extended generations of the Butler family for many years. Beg your pardon. With that, we'll get back to the rules. Have each of you a copy of the rules? Have each of you had an opportunity to at least glance through those? These are rules that are standard in each of the committees, I'm told. I've reviewed them earlier in another committee. You perhaps have as well. As the chair, I am going to make a motion that we approve the rules, and that's open for discussion. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and approve the rules. Now, it takes two members to ask for a roll call vote, according to the rules we've just passed. And if you would like to have roll call votes, we can do that when we get ready to go to that place. And it might be appropriate that we do it more often, and just nudge me if you feel like that you'd like to have a roll call vote. Otherwise, we'll just note for the record those that would be in opposition to any action that we would take for the record, and then move on from there. If that's acceptable. Probably not. She's shaking her head.
My understanding is if one person objects.
A motion upon the request of two members, a roll call vote shall be taken to record any question. Okay. And when we get to that particular point, if there's issues, we'll sort those through. Thank you, Kim. Mm-hmm. And I know that a lot of folks are really anxious to do roll call votes on certain issues, but if we don't have any objection, there's no reason for us to take the extra 30 to 45 seconds on each matter to go down a roll call vote. So with that. And I'll try to be very sensitive and even come back and open it up if there is an objection, and I haven't noted your objection so that you can be a no on something. But if we get into contentious things where we're going to split some votes here, then we'll come back and do roll call vote. As I say, just nudge me because I may not be savvy as to what's contentious for you and not for me.
Mr. Chair,
I'm sorry, I neglected to introduce our committee staff.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I introduced our kind of analytical staff, but Christy Bowman is going to serve as committee assistant, so she'll be here with us every day. And Kim James is our office manager. And you can see the chair has already deferred to Kim on a question, and it's because Kim knows everything. So, and she's if you have questions on anything where we are in terms of staff work for you, Kim is a good place to go.
Excellent. Thank you, Kim. If Kim isn't on your speed dial, put her on, and then you'll have her there so that she'll keep you posted on what things you should do. With that, we have adopted then the committee rules, and we'll now come back to Paul for. First of all, members, are there any questions? I would like to run a fairly informal ship, but recognize that we've got to follow the standard Mason's rules, and that's one of the things we've just adopted. So we'll try and do everything we can to keep it running at a good speed. And Kim, if you'll help us get an opportunity so that during the next 2 weeks, each member at the dais can come up here and take their place as chair, I would really appreciate that. And then, and that way you'll have a schedule and know when it's going to be your day so that you won't be 20 minutes late. Not that anybody would be 20 minutes late, Representative Escobar.
Well, it's Senate time.
Pardon me?
It's Senate time. It's hard to break.
Senate time, hard to break. Well, I came in on mountain time. I am the only member of the legislature that has two time districts, two time zones in his district. So, colleagues, let's, if there are no further questions, we'll go ahead and turn this time over to staff. And he's got the first question.
I got the first question. No, I'm noticing under Senate rule, under your, House rules for the committee number three, notice the time and place to be set by the chair. And you had discussed 1 versus 1:30, and I wonder if you wanted to bring that up to the committee.
Let's do it 1 o'clock. For Senator or Representative Esquivel, and 1:30 for everybody else. That way we'll all be here at 1:30. How's that? Colleagues, while we're...
Drag me around the parking lot. Tied to the bumper.
You already told me to see me afterwards at the door outside.
Mr. Chair, are you speaking about mountain time or Pacific?
Let's do this for the balance of our couple of weeks of orientation. And orientation is going to be very important, because I want to have everyone come up to speed equally together on this if we possibly can. So let's be here for orientation. But for the balance of orientation, let's plan to meet at 1:30, if that's acceptable. 1:30. And Senator Esquivel, or Representative Esquivel, that's 1 o'clock for you.
1 o'clock Senate time.
1 o'clock Senate time. And I've got to tell a story at that particular point. I'm sorry. But my very first session here, I chaired General Government Ways and Means, and we've had an identical situation. A member of the House had just gotten elected that had been an appointed senator in that previous time and had served in the Senate. And somebody came forward and said, "Well, Senator, here's..." And they stopped and said, "Well, let's see, I can't call you senator. I guess call you representative. But I really should be calling you senator, because you should always be addressed by your highest title." And I was the chair, and I sat down and I said, "Well, wouldn't that be Dad?" That's the highest title I've got. So, with that, Dad, and you're really not my son. You may spot me a little bit there. So, Paul, we'll come back to you then. We've got
Mr. Chair, you have before you the draft House Revenue Committee work plan, and that is really based on work that's done of an interim by the interim House Revenue Committee and the Joint Committee before that, and also discussions with the chair. It lays out a series of themes at the beginning, the first of which being the management operations of the current revenue sources, and that's a theme you'll see looking at the issues. A number of them fit into that category. The second is stability of the state fiscal system. We'll talk a bit about that today as I go through an overview of the revenue system. And the third item is the state and local revenue system, third theme, and how that affects the state's economic performance. And that's, I think, an issue that I'm sure you've all discussed during your campaigns, is that Oregon's economy has performed relatively poorly over the last 5 years after a period of pretty strong growth. So those are the themes that are laid out. There's a series of issues there, the first being tax compliance and collections process. You have a series of bills. We're starting to get bills come in now that have been referred from the speaker's desk. I got a collection of about 10 of them today. So we keep them in a file, and so those bills are available to be scheduled. There's always a series of routine bills around the administration, the income tax and the property tax, but there's also a series of bills that are looking at ways to try to make that system work more efficiently. We do have a day scheduled, an orientation for the Department of Revenue to walk through their processes. Director Harchinko has invited the committee to come over in March with the height of their collection processing, when they're processing the income tax returns, for the committee to get some first-hand view of how that works. So that's an issue that you'll see, I think, in a number of different bills. The second major issue is non-tax revenue sources. If you just look at the dollars and numbers in the governor's budget of proposed revenue changes, the biggest, of course, is the change in the lottery makeup of games to introduce line games. That's $120 million in the governor's recommended budget, the biggest revenue increase from a policy choice. Now, the way the mechanics of that work, that won't come before you as a legislative decision unless leadership decides to go that route. But the commission now has the authority to introduce those games, and that process is underway. We've invited director of state lottery, Dale Penn, to talk with you about kind of where that process is and how lottery intends to proceed. Another issue is the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This is both of these sources and some others as well are really net transfers. There's a gross revenue that comes in from these operations, and then there are costs associated with that, and then the net is what's transferred to you for allocation or appropriation in the budget. The third theme is connection to the federal, or third issue is connection to the federal income tax law. You have a major bill that connects to federal changes that have passed since the legislature regular session ended a year and a half ago. The biggest one, really the most complex one, is the corporate income tax changes that were contained in federal legislation passed in November of last year. And so there's a whole series of issues for you. Some of those things we do connect to automatically through a rolling reconnect provision we have. Others you don't. So you have to make a decision on those one by one, what things that you feel are appropriate for the state to connect to. And there's a whole series of issues on that. CPAs Association comes and works with us, works with the Department of Revenue. They'll have a presentation for you on the implications and the various components of those federal changes. The other issue that's kind of lurking in the background, and my sense is it probably won't be a big issue for you in this session, but could well be in the interim and in 2007 session, that's the president's a proposal to reform the federal tax code. As you may have noticed, he appointed a commission last week that will be looking at the federal tax code. That potentially has huge consequences for the state, depending on how that plays out. In fact, the last time we've seen something major was in 1986. Senator Packwood was the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee at the time, major federal reform. The 87 legislature revenue committee spent most of that session working through those changes. And that was the last really significant change to Oregon's income tax code. The other issues that we have listed, the estate tax law, we've been in a state of flux. We've had a couple of major federal changes, both in 1997 and 2001. Right at the end of the legislative session in 2003, there was a bill, House Bill 3072, that connected the state to the 1997 changes. It was silent on the 2001 federal changes. So that issue has come up. We've also had some issues you may have heard from your constituents in terms of implementing 3072. So that's something that we'll look at and see what options are there. Economic stimulus I've listed there. Of course, the difficulty with economic stimulus on the revenue side is what you do here, you have to coordinate and match up with the budget side, the Ways and Means side, ensuring that it's consistent with budget policy. The other issues that we have listed are the spending limit reserve fund. This grows right out of the work of the interim. There was extensive work on that. The state school funding distribution formula. One of our economists who wasn't here, Steve Meyer, does our school finance work. The revenue committees since 1991, when it was created, have been the committee that has done the work on the school distribution formula. And that formula has been tweaked and changed marginally since then, but still the foundation remains in place. And it's an extremely powerful tool because it allocates the state school fund to the 198 districts. So you'll see some proposals in that area, and we'll spend some time reviewing that with you and how that current formula allocates to the different districts. The last issue that's listed there is state short-term and long-term borrowing policies, and this, in fact, we just added this from an initial draft based on discussions with the chair. What kinds of overall policies does the state have in terms of borrowing? We have done a lot of borrowing just for operational purposes here during the fiscal problems we've had in recent years, particularly the appropriation credit bond issue, the $450 million issue. The Treasury has gotten some additional authority, for example, to issue tax anticipation notes. It was granted during the 2002 special session. So those issues can be looked at along with some other proposals that come from the Treasury and from other sources on how the state should shape that bonding and borrowing policies.
Thank you very much, Paul. Now, colleagues, this isn't necessarily at this point, this draft of the work plan isn't necessarily all-inclusive. If you look on the very, very last page, by flipping that over, you'll see that will consume until June 23rd, when the speaker becomes a grandmother, so at which time we'll all be home. At this particular point, we offer you the projected work plan, the proposed work plan draft, and the projected time frames. Please, we won't vote on whether or not we're going to accept it at this time. I think that gives us a kind of a framework to know what it is that we'll be planning to discuss. But if you see that there are deficiencies or need to be additions as you get more exposure to the process, keep that handy and please let us know that you have some particular issues that you believe that should be revenue issues that you feel fall outside of the framework, or let's see if we can fit it within the framework of the proffered 8 or 9 points there. So with that, we'll go ahead. Yes, Representative Berger.
If I may just comment briefly on the projected timeline, because I see something that pops into my head, which is that in April, listed issues around the state distribution formula and other school finance things, I would encourage us to work a little sooner on those, knowing the school budget calendars, that if we are going to do significant work with regard to education funding, I think it would behoove us to do it earlier rather than later in the session.
And we will, thank you very much, Representative Berger. I appreciate your comment there, and we will have in the very first of March, we'll have the forecast, which will give us more information relative to what may be available for distribution at that point. So we want to be cognizant of that, and I am concerned that schools have a budget upon which they can begin to make their allocations for the next school year. Other comments for the chair to recognize? With that, Paul, can you just address quickly, we will be into the school funding formula a couple of times, at least in this process. And Representative Berger, I'd have to say also that we probably will be back in, even when we're closing up in May and June, back into that. So the timeline doesn't say that's touched on once and never again. So other comments or concerns from members of the committee, please feel free. The only inappropriate question is the one that didn't get asked. So, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to excuse myself and
please
go down to the computer.
Thank you, staff members, for your participation here today. And the chair is going to yield the gavel to
Representative Hass.
Representative Hass, please.
Chair, I'd like to spend the rest of our meeting today kind of walking through an overview of the revenue system, and that the copy of these slides are in your packet, and you'll get a series of these. If you look at our orientation schedule, what we'll do is take an overview today, And then tomorrow, Elizabeth Martin Mahar will walk through with you the personal income tax and the components of that, how that system has worked. We'll be looking at a lot of data, a lot of information. You will have the hard copy of that. We will put it on the website. So that orientation material will be available to you throughout the session and whenever you need it. This is, of course, an opportunity for you to ask staff of any questions. This is your chance to go through kind of the big picture to look at how the system works before we really get into some detailed questions, as you will very shortly when you start looking at individual bills. The other thing I'd like to mention, you have our public finance basic facts publication there. That's, I think, our best seller. That has kind of everything in it, and we've updated that on an annual basis. It has some of this, some of my material that I'll go through is in there, but it has a lot of history that you really don't find anywhere else. One of the things I found is it's true of revenue and budget history. It's hard to find it in any one place, and you're literally back plowing through old documents to try to get something comparative to where we've been in our fiscal situation. But I will give you some today and this overview. In fact, I'll give you about, I think, as much as you'll find anywhere in terms of how the state revenue system has changed and the patterns that we've seen. I really wanted to address three questions. One is an overview and a comparative view of our revenue system. How does it stack up against other revenue systems around the country? Now, that doesn't mean there's any ideal revenue system, but that at least gives us a pretty good comparison of how Oregon's system is, and I think you'll find it's very unique, quite distinct from the other revenue systems in the country in a number of ways. How has that system changed? We all know Measure 5, Measure 50, and you can see that it has changed some ways, of course, I think you're very well aware of, others perhaps not, and how our system compares the way it looked 15 years ago. The other thing that I have is a number of slides looking at our current revenue situation. We'll look at the governor's budget, what are the assumptions in that budget, and the governor's revenue proposals. There aren't as many as we've typically seen in a governor's budget, and I think the governor made that clear in his address to you on Monday. But there are some policy decisions you'll have to make and respond to, and also to see those assumptions that go into that budget. And as the chair pointed out, we'll have an update on the forecast in March and then again on May 15 to see how the environment may change from when you have to make final decisions versus when he made decisions on his recommendations. The final thing, I'll look at kind of just an overview of strengths and weaknesses in the system. And I think what you'll find on revenue policy is, you know, there's no perfect revenue policy. If you try to address one particular weakness, you tend to create problems somewhere else. So you've always got to make that decision. Are the benefits we get from dealing with this problem worth the cost of making something else worse? And so that's kind of the tricky part of revenue policy, is dealing with those trade-offs. First of all, we do have the census data came to us in August of 2004. Every 5 years there's a census of government. So this is very detailed data and will allow you to make some good comparisons. And we're always asked, well, how does Oregon rank? And there is what appears to be almost contradictory findings when you look at our overall revenue, our overall spending, and our personal income taxes, certainly, is no surprise. But our overall revenue in particular, we rank 11th among the states in revenue per person. And I'm saying revenue, not taxes, but revenue. And that's an important distinction that we'll see. And I think if you look through your proposed work plan, there's a lot of issues, a lot of revenue issues that are not tax issues. In the middle, there's a category called own source revenue that subtracts out federal revenue. You see that's a huge issue for Oregon. And we rank 28th on a per capita basis, or pretty much near the middle. So thinking that federal revenue's in this category, this total category up here, but not here, gives you an idea how dependent we are on federal revenue. The other component is property taxes, and you'll see that's been the big change in the system. We've gone from a high property tax state to an average in terms of collection. And then near the bottom, you add up all of our state and local taxes per person, the 2001-2002 fiscal year, there are nine states with a lower per capita tax burden. So this is the contradiction we're often asked about. How can you be a high revenue state and a low tax state? Well, this data shows you how that has come about. Consumption taxes, by consumption taxes, of course, retail sales taxes, but I'm also including excise taxes, cigarette, gasoline. And when you throw those two together, we write 50.
Excuse me, Paul, can you explain or elaborate on that distinction between revenue and collection as to, we've talked about this before, whether it's mm-hmm. workers' comp rates or things that don't go to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, I think the easiest thing to do is to look at those components. And those are all the components that go into revenue. There's actually six categories that the census uses. And taxes being one of them. And you can see of all of these revenue sources that it's about $6,600 per person in Oregon per resident. And taxes are less than half that, $2,558 per person, sum of all taxes that are imposed. We do, by the way, also have in your basic facts, your public finance packets, a list of every tax, every state tax, and how many dollars were collected. So there's a comprehensive list of all the state taxes on that table.
Chair. Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, could you help me understand the consumption taxes per person were 50? What are the consumption taxes? Is that like tobacco, or what's the consumption tax in Oregon?
The taxes that I have included there are these, it would be these selective sales taxes in this category is what the census calls them. They are essentially tobacco, gasoline. They are alcohol. You know, a lot of states that don't have a OLCC-type state monopoly have alcohol taxes, excise taxes. Beer and wine taxes would fit in that category. It's anything that's based on the consumption in the state of particular commodities. This other taxes category here includes things like severance taxes, a weight mile tax is thrown in there, for example. So these would be, you know, we use the word consumption taxes to describe a retail sales tax, but I think it is important to recognize that a retail sales tax, the way they work in most states, about 25 to 30% are paid directly by business on business-to-business purchases. So there is a big component of that, the way the U.S. Retail sales tax system is operated. But if you look at these sources, you can see the second largest here is federal government. These are federal government transfers to state and local governments. Now, you may have seen some data that shows that Oregon's terms of trade, as we call it, with the federal government, is generally negative, that our taxes paid are less than the money coming back from D.C. And we do have that data. Actually, we have some very good data on that. But that includes transfers to private businesses and individuals. And Oregon has traditionally ranked right near the bottom in procurement spending, which is predominantly defense. We don't have much of a defense industry. So the state is ranked low in those transfers. But if you look at just the state and local government, you can see we rank fourth in terms of that amount.
Paul, some examples? Or
if you look at this figure, which for the total U.S. last year was about $400 billion. It's a huge figure. And Oregon, of course, is about 1% of the population, so we're actually getting more than that in terms of the dollars coming in. 45% of that is health-related.
So right? OHSU research.
OHSU would be part of that, but the biggest category is Medicaid.
Okay.
So, and that's the Oregon Health Plan, basically.
It tracks all that matching money from Medicaid.
Matching money. And that's where we've seen the fastest growth as well. But other large transportation is another big category.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, Just so I get clear on this before you go on to the next slide, which I'm sure will be easier than this. When you say federal government rank fourth on your first chart, the ranking is based on the percentage of something, or is it actual dollars? Do you understand the question?
Yes, Madam Vice Chair, the it's all ranked on dollars per person. So okay. What I've done is I've taken all 50 states, and I've got a great big spreadsheet, and I've got all 50 states, and I've got the population for each state. So I take each one of these categories, and I divide it by the population. Okay. And then I have a little ranking routine that ranks them all. And so what we're saying is there's only three other states that have more than $1,829 per person from the federal government.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining that.
The other way to rank these that you'll see is as a percent of personal income,
right?
Which is another way to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. The other category that we tend to rank high in the top 10 anyway, is in charges for services. Now, there's sometimes a gray area between charges and taxes, but charges for services are where you have an identifiable beneficiary who is paying directly the cost of that service. The largest component of this is higher education and tuition. That's the biggest component. The second biggest component is health care, where you make co-pays on public hospitals or publicly owned hospitals, and any charges that they have. In fact, I was looking at the details of this. Even when you buy a sandwich in the cafeteria of a publicly owned hospital, it shows up in this category as a charge. This, as you'll see, has been an area where we've seen growth in terms of revenue, and it's a big component of the governor's budget, the state components. The Department of Administrative Services does do a survey of all state agencies looking at fees and charges that are contained in the budget, and we'll make sure you have that report when it's finished in a few weeks. The next component is miscellaneous. Miscellaneous, over half of that is interest earnings on these government accounts. So this category has been trending down over the last 10 years because interest rates have been so low. But the other component here, and what's particularly important in Oregon, is lottery. Lottery is considered a miscellaneous. Now, you know, you can see where you get some of these categories. I'd mentioned earlier about Oregon being low last in consumption taxes. Some might consider lottery to be almost a consumption tax because it's based on a particular gaming activity. But the way it's classified in data, it's in effect a state monopoly. And the state shows up as a miscellaneous revenue source.
Mr. Chair. Representative Butler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, does in the lottery information that's given to us from the lottery, and I realize we'll have an opportunity to visit with Mr. Penn, but do we have some demographics about people that play the lottery in the state of Oregon, and do we know one out of how many people that are Oregonians play the lottery, and then out of 10 lottery players, how many of them are not Oregonians? Do we have that information?
Mr. Chair, the lottery does do surveys, and they know their market pretty well. So they do have a lot of that information. We'll make sure we pass that on to them, and so they can give you the latest that they've got. But they know that they do quite a bit of work on it.
Thank you.
The last two categories, actually I've combined two categories into one here. It's a category called government enterprises, which are, you know, you could almost argue the lottery could be in this category, but it's not. It's in miscellaneous. What is in this category is OLCC, which operates as almost like a business. It's a government-owned monopoly. Another component here is publicly owned utilities show up here, particularly under the local finance. Under the insurance trust funds, which is a separate category, but I've lumped in here, these are public employee retirement system, workers' compensation insurance fund. These are current flows of revenue into those funds. And if you look at my all funds budget, and I'll show you that in a minute, that's in the governor's budget, you see a huge component on earnings. Those earnings are predominantly PERS earnings.
I'll talk about those in a minute because those have varied a lot. Some of these insurance trust funds for some of these state for some states are negative. So meaning that their outflow exceeds their inflow coming in on their current operations. Now our PERS, for example, shows up as a positive in the census data because you hear about a unfunded liability, but that's a future projection. Right now there's more dollars flowing in than there's going out. I listed the own source revenue. Own source revenue consists of taxes, charges, and miscellaneous, those three components. So if you add those three up, we rank 28th, $4,300, and all revenue is at just a little short of $6,600 per person, ranked 11. Now, the tax system, if you just rank the major components of taxes, the personal income tax, of course, we're very high. In fact, we're typically higher. I should say, these numbers are a little bit low because the 2001-2002 fiscal year, there was a kicker pay, one that's currently in dispute in the court system now, $253 million kicker, that the Bobo decision now could add to it. And you may or may not get a decision on that before you wind up the session, but that could be a very significant fiscal issue for you. And the other thing is we did make a final $111 million payment to taxes on federal pensions that had to be refunded because of a court decision. So both of those one-time factors pushed down our personal income taxes for this particular fiscal year. Normally this number's in the third or fourth category. In fact, we've even had some years where we're number one. Corporate, we tend to be around the middle. Again, this bounces around a lot. And depending on, we have, and Elizabeth will walk through with you the corporate income tax, and you'll see a relatively small number of corporations pay almost all the corporate income tax. So their fortunes, their net income, the huge effect on that number. Property tax is 27. Sales taxes, there are four other states that don't have a sales tax. Alaska has some revenues classified as gross receipts, so they're actually 46. And then we're tied with Montana, New Hampshire, and Delaware. Sales, selective sales taxes, we mentioned those. Those tend to be on specific commodities, and then other taxes are a catch-all category. So you can see how the system ranks in those various components compared to other states.
Sure. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, as I recall, last session there was a bill that attempted to pass on some fees to stockbrokers and analysts and those sorts of folks, and it was going to raise a whole lot of money for the state. I don't think it was very successful in raising the money, as I recall. But where would that fit into the overall scheme of Oregon's tax system? Because it was money that didn't stay with the stockbrokers to help build up education fund or something like that, but it was to come to the general fund.
Mr. Chair, I believe those showed up as charges, although we haven't seen them in the census data yet because this is 0102.
Okay.
It's possible that they could show up as other taxes when they make that classification. Say there's a gray area there, and I think that's a good example of one because those fees were on a specific activity, but they were really raised for general governmental purposes. So the census will have to make a call on that where they'll classify.
Call out, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Paul, my recollection is that there was also some funds of other agencies, other funds that were converted to the general fund, and that, again, probably is outside the scope. Will those show up? Those were fees that were charged, as I recall, to nurses or to doctors or to somebody else, a landscape architect, that really aren't government fees, but I guess maybe they are, but many of them might have been professional fees that were eventually diverted in part to the general fund. Will those show up in this overall scheme?
Those will not show up because they are fund transfers. They were ending balances, in effect. So they will show up as a revenue from where they came from originally, as charges in most cases. And then once they got into those accounts, they were then transferred in the general fund. So they were fund shifts rather than new revenue.
Follow up one more, if I may. So basically, to be a fund transfer, you had to have already accounted that money as it came in somewhere else. So it's probably under selected sales taxes or something like that, or other kinds of fees that are charged.
Charges.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
This graph looks at state taxes, and I think it probably, more than anything else, shows the unique nature of the state's tax system. I'm not talking revenue here, just taxes. That if you add up all the taxes that the state collects, 70% comes from the personal income. You can see that number is even higher in the general fund. There is no state that has a bar of these categories this high. Okay, that's the highest single bar. If we were to line up all 50 states, that's the highest single bar. The second highest bar would be Washington, and the census adds both the Washington retail sales tax and the business and occupation tax. That's about 64% of Washington's total tax collection. And that's second.
So no other state is as dependent on one single tax as well. Not even close.
And you can see, we had a brief period in the 90s where the red bar here, for the first time in history, or first time since the 30s when they were both really used at the state level, in which personal income taxes exceeded general sales tax. But that was due to the bubble in the stock market and the capital gains that came from that. As income taxes wind down, you'll see here in a minute, they've been hit very hard by the recession. Sales taxes moved back ahead. Now I've just looked at, again, I'm back to revenue systems now, and including all the revenue together. And this is just kind of a comparative group that we like to look at. The first thing when you're just doing state and you're doing comparisons, first thing you need to do is say, well, how important is the state in the revenue system? How centralized is it? Well, in Oregon, if you look at revenue, we're pretty centralized. And part of that has to do with the components we have, but we're actually more centralized than anybody here except Idaho of our western comparative states. Here's our per capita revenue. Per capita, we rank 17, or we ranked 11 for state and local. We ranked 17 for state only. Close to California in relative ranking and really ahead of our neighbors here in terms of particularly the southwestern states in terms of dollars per capita total. But also notice that our taxes here at 34.9% are by far the lowest. In fact, this number here is the lowest. I want three other states that have a lower percentage.
Paul, could you elaborate on that?
Yeah.
What percentage of total?
Mr. Chair, these shares here are taking this total amount, this total revenue per capita, and saying, well, how much of it comes from taxes
okay.
for the state? The answer is 35%. But in California, it's 51% from taxes. So if you add these percentages down this way, you'll get to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And you also notice that at least was surprising to me when I first made this table, is that our federal revenue at the state level, now I'm zeroed in on the state, not state and local total, is actually higher than our taxes at 38.5% of our revenue.
Representative Perkins.
Thank you. Let me get this right. Let me restate this and see if I understand what you're telling me, Paul.
Okay.
Our revenue from federal sources is a higher percentage of our overall revenue than our revenue from taxation within the state. Is that what you're telling me?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
That's very interesting.
Mr. Chairman, question? Paul, are there any other states in the union where that is indeed the case?
I believe there is. Now, I'll have to look at that because I've got all of these together. There, I did look at the percent share of taxes and there were three states that had a lower percentage. So I suspect those states may be. The states that have very high federal share tend to be the sparsely populated states with a large severance tax base. Alaska, for example, Montana, Wyoming, all very high in federal revenue. Of course, it's one of the factors that influences that is the percentage of your land that's owned by the federal government. Mm-hmm. So we rank high in that, but not highest. Alaska would rank higher. You can also see, again, the charges data comes out. We rank higher than our neighbors except for Utah. Miscellaneous revenue, again, here's the impact of lottery showing up in miscellaneous revenue, pushing that percentage high. And these two categories are relatively low, but I also mentioned that you see some negatives, and here's an example of Utah having a negative on its current flows of its trust funds.
Sure. Paul,
some idea as to why Utah is higher in its share of charges, nearly double that of almost any other state in the West, and really nearly so with Oregon. What is it that Utah does that they pass on in their share of charges, you know?
Mr. Chair, I don't know offhand, but I have about 10 charges categories, and I can produce those pretty quick, so you can see how they rank in each of those categories. So I can show you where Utah is and which one of them really stand out. As I say, the largest here is tuition and higher ed fees is where we tend to see the largest. It may also have to do with their health care system, because that's the second largest is health and hospitals. The third largest tends to be recreation-related charges. So I don't know in Utah which one of those really stand out, but I can produce that table pretty quick.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
My question, can I give my questions directly to Paul? Thank you. How is the regulation, since so much funding comes from the federal government, how is that federal funding distributed, or is that something we're going to get later on in orientation?
The federal dollars will show up in the budget.
Right.
And we can take a look at that. It's largely a budgetary issue. But, you know, as I said earlier, the biggest component is on the health care side, primarily right. through Medicaid and the Oregon Health Plan, is where you see the fastest growth and the largest total numbers. But there are other categories, too, like transportation. That's a big one, too, for federal dollars. But
Thank you. Any chance we could lower the lights? Just to
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Yes, Representative Bocas.
Thank you. I'm only slightly confused, but then I'm the low end here. So, back on page three, slide three, you indicated, and this goes back to Representative Berger's question, that taxes were $2,558 per capita, and the federal government inflow was $1,829. Mm-hmm. And then you just said on slide number six that in fact
not so far
state we received more in federal funds than we did in state taxes. Mm-hmm. Am I comparing apples and oranges, Paul? That number is definitely smaller on the federal than
mm-hmm. the answer to that distinction is first of all, for the total system, we still rank very high.
Okay.
Right. But this is the total state and local system.
Got it, right.
So that's the difference. As we move ahead to this chart, this is state only.
Okay.
So that's the difference. So in other words, the locals don't receive as high a percentage. Although, you know, some of those dollars are they go from state really to locals as a pass-through, and they'll show up as a local dollar, but really influence those, or show up as a state dollar, but they'll influence those local budgets as well.
Mr. Chair, may I follow up? Thank you. In your opinion, is that I understand, because in those flow-throughs, those are most likely flow-throughs of dollars that we have mandated down to them. Is that correct?
Well, the portion of those and a portion of those are dollars that have, you know, the how they're to be spent have been mandated by the federal government.
Right.
So, for example, school district dollars.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Notice I'm able to bump ahead a year because I get a little faster data on state taxes than I do on others. But this is, again, back to taxes. And you can see that on taxes, anyway, we're not as centralized. And, again, here's our 71% that stands out. So this is really, this chart is reflective of that graph you saw that had the big red bar for personal income taxes. And here's Washington, as I said, at 62%. This is the second highest reliance on any of these categories. The systems that are pretty evenly balanced are Idaho, Utah. Nevada, of course, does not have an income tax, nor does Washington. So you've got two states on our borders, and this, of course, becomes a big issue for you as you look at tax policy from a competitiveness standpoint. You've got two major states on our borders without an income tax, and so that always makes it difficult to compete with a 0% rate. Notice also that some of these states, and this gets to be, you know, almost a classification issue. Washington, for example, if you look at their general fund budget, and I'll show you their general fund growth in a minute, does have local, what we consider local property tax dollars that go to the state and then flow back to the schools. Whereas we don't count those school dollars that still almost 30% of the school operating costs are property taxes. We count those as local, even though we kind of wash them out for our formula.
Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Representative Gleason.
Paul, I had one question. In addition to stability that a system like you pointed to Idaho and Utah, where there's not so much reliance on one, apart from stability, which is pretty significant, other advantages to that?
To having a diversified system?
Yeah.
Representative Gleason, I would say yes. You know, as an economist, I've always been trained that whatever you tax, you discourage. So, and that makes sense. I mean, if you tax cigarettes, you're going to reduce sales. If you tax gasoline, you're going to say. If you tax income, you're going to discourage income-generating activity. If you tax consumption, you're going to discourage consumption activity. So whatever you have relatively more taxes on, you tend to discourage. Now, sometimes you can argue what's the extent of that, but the direction, I think, is indisputable. So if you look at the major tax bases, which are income, property, and sales or consumption, a balanced system would tend to spread that burden, and so you're discouraging each of those equally. If you're discouraging just one, then I think you're more likely to create distortions. But we'll see in a minute, and I'll come back. I'll talk a little bit at the end about strengths and weaknesses. Certainly the income tax has a lot of real strengths, too, so that come into play. But in terms of just creating distortions and causing economic actors in the marketplace to change their behavior, the more you tax something, the more likely you're going to change that behavior.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, coming to the slide that you just had relative to the share of the property taxes going to the state, Washington was at 11.6% and Oregon was zero. What of the interest on the property on delinquent property taxes? Doesn't the state take a portion of that back from local government when we moved it from 8% to 16% or whatever it was?
Mr. Chair, yes, that comes into the Assessment and Taxation Fund, the A&T Fund. That shows up in these data, does not show up as state property tax collections. It still shows up as local property tax collections. What the Department of Revenue does is mix them into a formula and then sends them back to the county assessment offices. But it doesn't show up here in the census data as a state property tax collection. So actually we have nothing that shows up as state property. The second question that we raised, the first one was comparing ourselves with other states. The second is, how has our system changed? And I've got 89-90 as kind of my base year here because Measure 5 passed in November of 1990. And that was really, as you'll see, really was a catalyst for significant changes in the system. And, of course, those changes were further pushed in the same direction by Measure 50, which passed in the spring of 97. So Measures 5 and 50, and they've done a number of things. Only, you know, my memory is getting a little bit stale here from the discussion of Measure 5, but only a few of these things I think were discussed at the time. One of them I don't remember being discussed. Representative Comp may remember, but I don't remember a lot of discussion about centralized school finance, which of course was one of the real effects of Measure 5, is to make a state finance school system. And of course that's put in terms of the Revenue Committee at that time dealing with a formula, and of course the Ways and Means Committee and trying to put the budget together now has a huge state school fund component that they didn't have before, or a much bigger one than they had. Lower property taxes have clearly happened, and we'll see those actual collection numbers in a minute. Lower overall taxes, and then we've seen these two categories that have kind of increased, and we'll see how they've filled in for some of these lower numbers here. The other thing that's happened in this period is we got a real sense of how our system responds to a boom and bust economy, particularly with the really exacerbated by the financial markets and the performance and of the stock market over the last 10 years. This looks at our property taxes and how they have changed under Measure 5, and really well before that. I think you can see some of the history here of the public's reaction to property taxes. Here was this red line is market value. And you can see here's the, you know, Governor McCall's visit and don't stay period in Oregon, a lot of in-migration, of course, a lot of inflation in the system at that time, too. And you'll see it when you look at general fund, it really exploded during that time, too. But you can see real estate value growing very rapidly, property tax dollars growing pretty rapidly as well. A lot of pressure on the legislature, particularly with Proposition 13 passed in 1978, a lot of pressure on the legislature to enact property tax relief, and they did. It's a major program, PTR program, property tax relief program, was a huge component of the general fund. It showed up as an expenditure. But what it did, it was a check to reduce property tax burdens. Well, we go into the 80s, we go into the recession of the early 80s and the budget crisis at that time. Look what happens to market values as the economy is very weak during the 80s. Basically flat, yet property taxes continue to grow. And what doesn't even show up here is the property tax relief was almost eliminated to balance the budget. So you get a series of initiatives to limit property taxes, each one. And by the way, one of the things we do have in the back of your public finance packet is a list of major tax votes going back. I think our first one in there is the McCall plan in 1973. So it's got 30 years of votes, you know, vote counts on major revenue proposals, votes. But if you look in there, you'll see a series of property tax initiatives. Each got closer to 50%, and finally, Measure 5 here in 1990 was what put that in the Constitution. Now, notice, just at the time that occurs, we go into a real estate boom. As during this time, California values were growing relative to ours. Ours were very flat. Both California and Washington had stronger real estate growth. We caught up in this period, but collections dropped as the rates were phased down to eventually to $15 per thousand. But remember that Measure 5 had no limits on assessed values. It was all strictly a rate limit, mostly on schools, taking that school rate, which had averaged about $16 per thousand statewide in 1990, and reduced it to $5 per thousand. So here's what happened to collections. And you can see the collections did fall. These are just dollars collected. They fell about 12% during this period, even though values were growing rapidly. As we were in a bit of a real estate boom, the economy was picking up. Then we get 95-96, when the rate reductions have been fully phased in. We're at $5 per thousand. So what happens under that Measure 5 system? Your property tax is solely determined by changes in your property value. So what happened to property values? Well, they're still booming up here, saying they're still growing about 12%. Property tax bills jumped 12%. Those were in the mailbox October of 1996, and November of 1996, Measure 47 was on the ballot. So you can see the convergence of those. And then here's the drop, the cut and cap measure. Here's the drop in collections or in levies. There's about a 2% drop the first year. And then here's the effect of the limit. You can see it's property taxes have still grown about 5 to 6% a year, and you'll see they've been much more stable than have the personal income tax in this recession. So we've learned once again what we knew.
Yeah, Paul, on the market value of the property, I see from the year 2000 forward it's kind of a decline and then a slight upswing. Now, under, 47, where we went back 10 years or something like that with the assessed value or something like that, and then we capped at 3% growth per year. Now, my question is, if it's booming up 3% per year no matter what, wouldn't we have a steady increase here, plus the fact that we would be getting new construction, which we've had quite a boom in building? And if so, when you have new construction, do they start at the base that the house was sold at, or do they do comparables?
Representative Escobar, several questions there. One is that, yes, we look at a long-run rule of thumb is that we think that property collections and levies will grow about 5% a year. 3% on existing property, which is in Measure 50, 3% per year, and about 2% long-term average new construction. Now, of course, that's going to vary a lot by different regions of the state, but we think that's about the long-term average. In terms of the fluctuations, what we've seen here, you see some, but largely this has stayed right around the 5%. And if you look at the market value here, compare it with this, recession of the early 80s. And, you know, that tells you this is definitely a different kind of recession. Number one is that because interest rates were so low, mm-hmm. the real estate markets held up pretty well compared to the early 80s. So that, in terms of how Measure 50 was implemented, it was passed in 1997. Assessed values were rolled back to their 95-96 level and then cut 10%. And then a permanent rate was established.
With a 3% cap.
With a 3% cap on assessed value, the permanent rates are permanent.
Now, I guess the real question here is, we've had acceleration of value in the real estate market in some points, certain portions of this state. Example, 21-23% 1 year, 18% another year, 17.43% a third year. That's 3 years running. When these homes are sold, do they go to that market value that they're sold for, or do they remain back at this Measure 50?
Representative Escobar, they go to what's called the change ratio value, and we'll walk through that with you when we go through the property tax, but each of these tax code areas has a change ratio, a ratio of assessed to market value. So they would go to a like property ratio. So if the change ratio is 80%, meaning that the assessed value is about 80% of the estimated market value in that comparative group, they would stay in that change ratio.
Thank you. I'm still confused. I'm a simple farm boy. Go back to 1980 and 85, and your red line is your property value line, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And this is purely based on, because property values have climbed steadily, period, end of subject. But explain to me what the red line means here in layman terms, Ian. I'm confused, because it looks to me like you're saying that property values have gone down, not up.
Representative Boquist, these are annual percent changes.
Okay.
So all we're saying that the percentage growth has slowed,
okay,
but not the booming as it was in the early 90s. And it just, you know, the Measure 5, just by happenstance, the timing of it, went into place just as the real estate markets were coming back.
Thank you.
After a down period.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Plot forward.
Before our eyes hang over.
The consequences of the for the state budget, of course, I think are pretty well known, that basically you had a complete shift in state and local responsibility for schools. You went from 30% state finance to 70% state finance. This is school operating revenue, not capital included here. So this was the change that came about from Measure 5. This chart looks at the how the different revenue sources responded to the boom bust that occurred in the 90s and into the 2000s. My red bar here is personal income tax for all states in the country that have a personal income tax, so it's a total composite number there. Notice, and these are annual growth numbers, so notice you're getting up over 10% in the late 90s, back in 98, for example, running 8 to 10% pretty consistently. This is also relatively low inflation period, 2 to 3% inflation, so very strong real growth. Here's the recession hits, the 2001, but really 01 to 03 recession in terms of its impact. Notice the drop here from about 7% growth in 2001 down to about 12% decline in 02, and then about a 3% decline here. So those of you that participated in the special sessions remember this very well, that you know, when those numbers started coming in, they were much worse than anybody expected they would be, and we end up with very significant drops in the general fund forecast, and we end up with special session. Notice the how sales taxes have performed over this period, growing about 5% a year, and then dropping to about zero, and then starting to pick up to about 5%. You can also see the recovery starting to come into place here in 03, 04, as those numbers have just come in. Washington, Oregon, comparison of general fund. There's some other components in the general fund, but you can see that same pattern here with Washington. These are biennial numbers, two-year. They have a two-year budget cycle, same as ours. Run about 5% a year, 10% a biennium. We're up here 20, 23%. And then, of course, we're down 7%. This number here, if the state hadn't sold $450 million worth of bonds in the spring of 03, this number would have been minus 13. Hmm. So you can see Washington's had some fiscal problems and some budget balancing issues to deal with, but their drop was not nearly as severe as ours.
And that's all due to the volatility of the income tax?
It's due to really two factors. One, the inherent volatility of the income tax versus the sales tax, and what really also the unique characteristics of this recession. And of course, you can ask, maybe they're not so unique, maybe future recessions will be like this, but it is certainly different than what we've had in the last four, in the post-war period. This current recession, low interest rates, things like automobiles held up very strong. 10% of the Washington sales tax base is automobile related. So they didn't get hit in that sector like they normally do. Housing held up very well. And while housing is not in the sales tax base, a lot of the components are, like furnishing, appliances, and so forth, are directly related to housing starts. So those components did well. And of course, on the other hand, for income taxes, the capital gains just exaggerated the swing immensely, both up and down.
Mr. Chair, questions? Paul, while you have the slide up there, trying to understand the economist's mind, when you're looking for comparatives, you could sort of geographically, what are the most important sort of criteria? Do you look population? Do you look geography? Do you look at sort of, revenue sources? In other words, when we're considering, where does Oregon lie? Why Washington? And, how should we, what do you look at first to say what's comparative to Oregon, for example?
Representative Belize, I think that we naturally look a lot at Washington, and for several reasons. One is they would be, if you look at our population center, 45% of our population lives right in the Portland metro area, which actually was within the same labor market as parts of Washington, Clark County. So there's naturally a real close link there. There are some other components that are the same in terms of the proximity or geography point. And of course, we have similar kinds of economic linkages, like foreign trade, for example, Asian trade. So those things make us similar. But the other thing that is, and I can't think of any other comparison like this. Maybe in the East there may be some, but you see all those similarities yet you see such a diametrically opposed tax systems. So that's what I think probably holds out the interest for us. We look at California a lot too because it has such a huge impact on our economy. But it's so big it just dwarfs everything that we would do. So I think Washington, Oregon's naturally that comparison because of the Northwest economy, the proximity and similarity there, and then the policy issue is very interesting because of the differences in the tax system. The revenue system. But these are my little box here. Only the difference is 89.90. I don't have good data on enterprises and trust funds, so I've given what's called general revenue, which excludes those. But you get the same feel here. Notice that our general fund is 12, and we're 11th, in 0102. But notice our taxes were 19th back then. And notice our property tax, well, I'm not to that yet. But we were 19th in terms of taxes, and we were 23rd in terms of charges, 9th in terms of federal. So these have both moved up, particularly this one, charges, where this has moved way down. And this has stayed about the same. So if you look at our taxes, we were 19th here, still high in personal income taxes, the same in corporate, property was 7th. So this went from 7th to 27th. Over that period. So this summarizes the system and how it's changed between these two periods. Taxes have gone from 54% of this general revenue, which excludes these smaller components, down to 42%. So, that's the change. Again, this is one of those legacies. I don't know is that well known of Measure 5. But this is the impact on the revenue system. Tax burden down, taxes as a revenue source way down. Look at the increase in federal. Now, my guess is, and I think it's probably a pretty safe one, that as you look ahead and think of future legislatures working with the budget, this number will probably shrink. We have a federal government now that's running about a $400 billion deficit that is putting in place a series of reductions or limitations on discretionary spending. State and local tends to be one of those categories. So I suspect you'll see real pressure here as the feds move to change their fiscal position to balance their budget. That there'll be downward pressure. Charges, you can see the jump here from 13 to 18. So clearly a shift from taxes to charges. And miscellaneous revenue, although this has dropped, it would have dropped a lot more if it hadn't been for lottery as a revenue source. So our current revenue situation, and again, these are the assumptions that went into the governor's budget, the December revenue forecast. The general fund budget shows about a $91 million ending balance. As we look ahead to 05-07, it's about 11, almost 11.2. I think the governor mentioned 11.9, while he's including lottery revenue in that. That's an 8.2% increase, so we are projecting growth. And if you compare us to where we were in 99-01, it's about 6.7% higher. So if you put these two numbers together, that means that 03-05 is lower than 99.01. Indeed, we are actually less in terms of general fund resources than we were 4 years ago. And that's the effect of the recession.
Paul, thanks for using that illustration of the gambling proceeds at the casino. Appropriate.
Mr. Chair, those are just dollars and cents there. That's revenue.
And not enough.
We can't do many pictures on revenues, but we can think of. This shows the importance, another illustration of the importance of the personal income tax. In this case, in terms of your general fund resources, just a note about terminology, resources, when we say resources, general fund resources, we're including this beginning balance. When you say revenue, you're excluding that. Okay. One of the impacts of recessions is that it tends to spill over, even if the economy returns to some normal growth rate, it tends to spill over because you have a very small beginning balance. And the expansion in the 90s, we used to have big ending balances that became beginning balances because revenue kept coming in more than was expected. So you tend to have that spillover effect. But if you just look at this big blue portion here, 0305, this is nearly 90%. So what's going to cause movements in general fund revenue? Well, it's pretty clear what's going to cause those movements. Although you do see some real swings here in the corporate income taxes. Corporate income taxes, for example, in 0103 biennium dropped nearly 50% compared to the prior biennium. Now, this is the all-funds budget that you'll see the detail of that in your public finance packet. I have a 10-year, actually now probably about a 15-year history of budgets in there. So I think that's something that's a good thing to come back to and give you some perspective on how these components have changed over time. But notice, again, you get the same message that we got from that census data is that, gee, when you look at the whole pie, taxes are a minority of it. And the purple portion here, even though they're the vast majority of general funds. Federal funds show up here as all funds budget, so-called other funds. Interest here is a bit of a misnomer. This is really earnings. And it's 90% public employee retirement account. This number went from, I don't have my chart here, it's in your basic facts. This number went from over $4 billion to less than $1 billion in two biennium, which partly explains the problems with the public employee retirement system, the boom in the financial markets, and then the sharp drop-off shows up in this other fund budget. Now, of course, the other thing is these dollars here, are really they're not available to you in terms of any kind of discretionary spending. They're not for general public services. Bond sales show up here. Sales, these could be sales of property. They also, OLCC shows up under this definition. Here's your charges component. Licenses, these are usually lumped together in the census data. And here's lotteries, a relatively small part of the pie, but because of, we'll see about 50% of it is discretionary, becomes an important decision point for you. Donations is a big one for higher ed and has grown rapidly as higher ed has been much more aggressive since Measure 5 in trying to get donations. And then another category is a catch-all category within the budget. Those discretionary revenue sources, again, general fund, and again, it's income tax, and the lottery, of which this number is shrinking, continues to shrink of what's available here. Now, I'm using current law projections, and I'm not calling line games current law. Even though you don't have to pass a law for those to come into place, the commission has to act to go that direction, for the lottery to go that direction, and then I would change that to a current law assumption when they formally change that policy. But what that'll do is the governor's got a $120 million estimate in his budget. That will increase the amount available for allocation by about 50% of that, but it'll also add 18% of that 120 will go to the stability fund, and 15% will go to the parks and natural resources fund. We'll come back to the stability fund because I think this will be an important issue to at least look and see where we're at. It was created in 2002 in the special sessions. The fund has been used heavily since that time to try to for the state's school fund, but it'll begin growing again and a projected ending balance of about $200 million in July of 07 is the estimate in the governor's budget. Now, this is my favorite chart because it took me weeks to put it together. I had to literally go back to the yellow copies of the Department of Revenue of old general fund budgets and the old tax commission from the 40s. And I've pieced this together. I won't swear to all the numbers, but they all have a source. And this shows you the revenue history. It's going back to the beginning of the income tax. In 1929 is when the income tax was first passed as a property tax relief measure. Because the state received a lot of property tax money at that time, the income tax was designed to provide property tax relief. Notice that, you know, when you look at the 0103, the 7% decline we saw earlier, notice the last time that happened. Last time we even had any decline was in 39-41. And the last time we had that big a percentage or bigger percentage decline was in 33-35. So, now I won't ask if anybody remembers that.
Oh, what accounted for the jump in the 79, that 70s?
You had two periods of you know, huge jumps in general fund growth. One that grew out of the war with that's when the corporate income tax was established. Income tax rates were significantly increased to pay for wartime activities. And then after the war, the economy boomed. It's when the federal lands began harvesting timber off federal lands. There was a housing boom. The economy just exploded. I mean, you look at the personal income numbers from then, huge growth in population and income in Oregon. So the income tax structure was set up and it just exploded. There was a series of plans to provide property tax relief, the so-called Walker Plan at that time. But you can see the phenomenal growth then. Then you settle into this pretty much, you know, 10% almost annual growth during the 50s and 60s. This was really the inflationary growth of the 70s. It was larger than what it was. You had changes in the consumer price index running, you know, almost 20% of biennial.
Yeah.
So that's where a lot of that. We had a big growth in the income tax. Income tax was not indexed for inflation. And then you can see the drop off here. This is, you know, this growth doesn't look all that outstanding historically, but inflation was low. So that's why it was such strong growth. You had 10% annual growth and 5 or 6% biennial inflation. And then here's the drop here again, the unique nature. And of course, the issue as you look ahead, is this going to prove to be some one-off unique event caused by the stock market, or is it more typical of the kind of business cycle we'll be in the future? This is the outlook for the general fund. You can see that the 0305 numbers run at about 9%. These percentages would look a little different if we pulled out that bond financing. This would be down about 13%, as we said, and this would be up about 12% or so. But here's the moderate growth that's built into your forecast that you'll be working with for your policy decisions, about 8.5% growth. And here's a return to trend growth out here at 12%. You may have noticed the governor, he referred to it again in his address to you on Monday, talked about a reserve fund, and that a reserve fund could be set up. Well, that's based on this return to this trend growth out here of about 12 to 13%. So what he's saying is to take a piece of that growth and put it in a reserve fund.
Hope the $450 million in bonding will be paid over, was it how many years?
Mr. Chair, I think it's over 8 years.
Okay. Over 8 years.
And it comes out of your master settlement revenue.
Right. And that's $112 million?
The amount that was borrowed was $450 million, and I just saw the proposed bill on it. think it's about $90 million would be debt service payment in 2005-07.
Okay.
So here's the governor's recommended revenue policies that are in the budget. Some of these will be handled directly in Ways and Means. Others, you will have bills to look at and consider. Expansion of lottery games, we've mentioned. Enhanced collections. There's a couple of proposals within the Department of Revenue budget, and we'll have the Department of Revenue come and describe their collections process, and they'll describe what those components are and what kind of changes that they would propose to make in that budget. We'll also look at some collections proposals from other states. There are 8 credits that sunset. Most of them are relatively small in their impact on revenue. They're about, I think about 4 of them are property tax, 4 are income tax. 2 of them, the 2 I've listed here, do have an impact, combined impact of about $2.5 million on general fund revenue. And they're recommended for extension in the governor's budget. And then there is a more of an accounting change, and this would really be dealt with at the Ways and Means process more than here, is to criminal fines and assessment revenue have gone into the general fund. That percentage has been upped in recent biennia, and this would increase it to 100%, have that money go into the general fund, and then be allocated to the programs that it supports through the normal Ways and Means process. So, a summary of the revenue system, there's my dollars and cents again.
Before you get the seat at the table.
Again, these are kind of the summary issues. One, we do have a relatively tax burden. That's certainly the case in 2001-02, probably a little less so now, but we probably rank in the high 30s in terms of per capita tax revenue when you adjust for those one-time changes we saw in 2001-02. But we do have very high reliance on these non-tax revenue sources, particularly federal funds and charges, the two that really stand out in comparison with other states. We're highly dependent on income taxes, most dependent in the country. Our tax burden, I haven't talked a lot about this, our OTIM model produces a result of how taxes are distributed among different income groups. And if you compare Oregon's system with other state local systems, we tend to be roughly proportional, meaning that people in different income groups pay about the same percentage of their income. Sales tax states, like Washington, for example, on these incidence studies, tend to be much more regressive, meaning that lower-income individuals pay a higher percentage of their taxes in a higher percentage of income in taxes. Strengths and weaknesses of the system. Strengths, the personal income tax, and I think you'll see this very clearly, a strength becomes a weakness in another perspective because it may solve one problem, create another. But the income tax is the most elastic, what we call elastic, of our taxes, of our major taxes. Elasticity is defined as the percentage change in tax revenue divided by the percentage change in income. So as income goes up or down, income taxes go up or down by a higher percentage than the change in income, meaning that when times are good, it's going to grow rapidly. When times are bad, it's going to drop rapidly. And, of course, we've seen that very clearly. But what happens over time, and you saw that in terms of that general fund chart going back to 1930, you generate strong revenue growth over time. Now, I would say that's clearly a strength because in terms of policy decisions, it puts you in a position, even if you think that the public sector should be smaller, it puts you in a policy position of reducing those rates and gives you flexibility in that regard. If, on the other hand, you want the public sector to grow, you've got that option. So strong revenue growth over time becomes a relative strength of the system over time. The difficulty that a lot of the sales tax states have now is because their revenue is not growing rapidly over time. They have an inelastic revenue source because services, untaxed services, are growing faster than taxable service than taxable items, and internet and other remote sales are not taxed. You look at sales tax growth and income, it's not keeping up with income tax growth. So as a sales tax state, in order to keep your revenue at the same percentage of your economy, you've got to raise rates, which is creates a number of problems both economically and politically. So in a sense, this system of growing over time allows more policy options. Federal support for public services, it does reduce the burden on Oregon residents. So in effect, you're spreading that funding of that services across the country. So that provides some stimulus to the economy and reduces the burden on your citizens. Proportional distribution, I would argue that a progressive system can create some disadvantages within an open system in terms of mobility across borders, and a regressive system creates equity issues. Appropriate charges are efficient if they reflect the cost of those services. That's just like a market. Weaknesses of the system, again, I think those things have come out pretty clearly. One is the instability of the income tax, and those of you who persevered through the five special sessions are well aware of the impact of that. We talked a little bit about marginal tax rates. It's marginal rates that are important, that 9% rate in Oregon's case on that last increment of income, because that's where economic decisions are made. And what our models tell us, our OTIM model, is you get responses both in terms of production and in terms of migration depending on changes in the income tax rate. So high marginal rates will tend to distort economic decisions because they reduce net returns. Federal dependence on resources reduces your policy control. If they give you mandates, or if they cut funding of particular programs, or if they even on the tax side, if they adjust the federal tax and we're connected, then those put you in a position of having to respond to that. And finally, excessive charges, and that becomes a policy issue over things like tuition, for example. When does that become a competitiveness equity issue? If they're seen as out of line relative to other competitive states, it may well create problems. So those are the overview of the system. That's the forest.
Well, thank you. I have to say that after I think I've been through maybe three terms and special task forces and committees of maybe seven or eight times, and every time I do pick up new useful information. And for the newer members who are suffering an information overload, trust me, that will continue every time you go through this. Thank you. Any questions of Dr. Warner? Representative Vestal.
What's interesting, though, is the chart you gave us that started in 1939, that we've only had about every 60 years we've had a decrease in growth in revenue. That's what's interesting, because I expected look like a heartbeat or something.
Mm-hmm. The growth over time, it shows you how unique the last period has been, and it shows you the responsiveness of the income tax, and it shows you how Oregon has been in a growth region. I mean, we have been a growing economy in a growing region historically.
Questions?
I have one question. Particularly interesting for me was the reliance on the federal funds, and considering where we are with the federal government and plans, how concerned are you with, assuming moderate rate of growth and absent major changes in the way Oregon's system is structured, where would that leave us?
I think that is a concern. There's a lot of scenarios that can play out. I mean, there's a series of things that are tied internationally. I think some of it ties back to the foreign trade deficit. We've seen in the paper today, it was released again, has grown. That's going to put downward pressure on our currency. It puts us in a position where we have to finance that federal deficit. We have to finance that trade deficit. I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on the federal government to deal with the deficit. And I think that it will affect all states. And given that we have seen this kind of growth, that I think it will have a disproportionate effect on us. So the other thing that we could see a bigger effect is federal tax reform, because we're so closely connected with it being so income tax dependent. So I think both of those areas, we need to watch the federal government very closely. Now, you can also take the other view and say the federal government has been a huge positive for the state the last 10 years. I mean, it really has helped the state get through the Measure 5 adjustment, provided a lot of funding. But that rate of growth simply can't continue, in my view. I think they're going to have to make some changes in fiscal policy. And they've already, starting on that course and made it very clear that that's the direction they'll go. I think if it's gradual and takes place over time, we can plan and respond to it. If there are sudden changes, then it can create a lot more disruptions.
Mr. Chair, I have a future question.
Okay, and we'll take it in the present.
Well, at some point, I'd be very interested to know a micro-analysis of the 90% personal income tax segment. And what I'm specifically interested in is, what is the life cycle of the taxpayers that are in there? Are we seeing more retirees? Are we seeing lower income jobs? And what is that life cycle over 5 to 10 years in front of us? Because you want to look at future reform, the issue, you can talk all this history, macroeconomics, but if we're getting more retirees, then that number is going to go down regardless. And therefore, is the 12% assumption of growth really a correct assumption?
Representative Bogus, I think the question about the 12% is a huge question. And I think that'll really dictate the kind of environment you have here. And you're right, I've been at a very high level in terms of that issue. And we just so happen to have Elizabeth Martin Maher, who's got a... You think I've got a lot of slides. She's got a lot of slides on income tax. And those are where you do see a lot of changes. When you look at the components of adjusted gross income, how has that changed? There's some real interesting trends there. And we see this in terms of some of the components of... as our population ages, you're absolutely right, the tax rate goes down on those groups. One thing, Social Security, for example, is excluded from state income taxes. So as that proportion grows, lower tax base. One of the issues that you recall from the 03 session was an adjustment, actually a reduction in the subtraction for elderly medical care. Right now, there's no income limit you can subtract on your Oregon return if you're over 62, your medical costs, in effect. That will grow very rapidly with not only the aging of the population, but also the incredibly strong growth in healthcare costs. So both of those issues will put a squeeze on the base. I think all states are affected by that. The same answer I had in terms of the federal government. All states are affected by that aging of the population. I think we're going to be affected more because the income tax is going to pick up that effect more.
May I follow up one question? Sure. Because I think the point in there is if we come more of a retirement, we all know the sustainability a little bit. We all want to live here because of great forest environment and everything else like that. But it draws, we may be at the point where we're drawing more retiree age individuals who are not paying into the taxes, and the system becomes overburdened. Mm-hmm. And the replacement jobs are not high tech, high dollar jobs. And that's the life cycle I'm looking for. We need to forecast out in front of us. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions for Dr. Warner? Representative
Berger? Briefly, Mr. Chair, if now is the time, and if not now, at some point I would request that Dr. Warner give us a 5 to 10 minute briefing on OTIM and what it is as a tool. And now may not be the good time, but I would request that.
Okay. Do that. Okay. Now's not a bad time.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how brain dead the committee is.
I could say just a few things of what OTIM is, and then we'll bring in some a handout so you can have something to take back with you. But the Oregon Tax Incidence Model was we built it in 1999. The legislature gave us some extra money to work with Oregon State. It is it's a model of the economy. It's what we call an input-output model. It's actually based on the same type of modeling that's been used on the forest planning, for example, on economic impacts. So it uses that base for the state, and it tracks through how different sectors are related to one another, how agriculture is related to different industries, how households are related. And of course, what we did was we got a way overblown government sector, very detailed, because that's what we're interested in. And what it does is it allows us to look at how changes in taxes, whether you have a sales tax or you would reduce the income tax, how that would affect wages, prices, jobs in Oregon. It's not a forecasting model. It looks at the current situation. It says, okay, if you have a different tax structure after an adjustment period, we assume it's 5 years, how is that system going to look? How is it going to be different because you changed your tax system? And we would show you how jobs would be different, how income would be different, what different sectors would do better under that. We use it to calculate what we call a feedback effect. So if you lower taxes, for example, you lose revenue. I know Tim is clear about that. But you don't lose as much revenue as the so-called static analysis where you don't look at economic feedback effect. So if you cut capital gains, for example, and you see proposals to do that, we estimate how much revenue you get back from more economic activity. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of help. We were very grateful from the California Department of Finance. Bruce Smith there did a lot of help putting it together. They have what's called their DRAM model, a dynamic revenue analysis model, and they had very well documented and came up and helped us with OTIM. So it has, I think, a pretty good vetting and background in its development, and it gives you, I think, a good tool to look at big pictures. I mean, it's not good at looking at, you know, real detailed changes in the income tax, but it gives you a sense of how tax changes might affect the economy, really how it might affect Oregon's competitive position, because it basically assumes Oregon's this open economy in this big world. You change something, how does that affect how Oregon interacts with the rest of the world?
Thanks. I'm sure we'll hear more about that.
Any other questions? Then why don't we adjourn until 1 o'clock, 1:30 tomorrow?
We're adjourned.
For me, it's 1 o'clock, Mr. Chair.
Oops.
We can always just delay start.
We'll say 1 o'clock Senate time.
There you go.
I like
it. I'm used to the
I was going to say, you know, what's going to happen here? Lights down.